Hi, everyone, and welcome to the SRHM podcast. My name is Nina Sun, and I am an associate editor for the SRHM Journal. In today's episode, Emily Mestralis, Senior Program Officer at the Helbron Department of Population and Family Health at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, is hosting a conversation with three colleagues on the impact of U.S. foreign policy on abortion worldwide. More specifically, they discuss the global gag rule, or the GGR, and how even though the policy was rescinded in January 2021, the effects continue to be seen globally. This episode builds on a special journal issue published by SRHM and Columbia University entitled Exporting Harm, Impact of the Expanded Global Gag Rule on Sexual and Reproductive Health and Rights. The journal issue includes research articles and commentaries on the GGR's impact in Nepal, Madagascar, Kenya, in humanitarian settings, and beyond. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the SRHM podcast. My name is Emily Mestralis, and I'll be your host for today. Today, we're talking about the global gag rule. The global gag rule is a U.S. foreign assistance policy that was first introduced by U.S. President Ronald Reagan in 1984 and has since been implemented by all Republican presidents and rescinded by all Democrat presidents. Today, we will most likely refer to the policy by its shorthand, the GGR, or perhaps the Mexico City policy. Until 2017, the policy required non-US-based NGOs that received US family planning assistance to certify that they would not use any funding to provide, share information about, or make referrals for abortion as a method of family planning, or to advocate for the liberalization of abortion laws. For those who might be less familiar with the policy and this terminology, abortion as a method of family planning does not include abortions provided in cases of rape, incest, or when the pregnancy threatens the life of the pregnant person. The Trump administration expanded this policy twice. In 2017, President Trump reinstated and expanded the GGR by applying it to nearly all of U.S. global health assistance, which is approximately $11 billion U.S. dollars. In contrast, under the administration of George W. Bush, the GGR applied to approximately $600 million of just U.S. family planning assistance. The second expansion under the Trump administration required non-U.S. NGOs that chose to comply with the GGR to pass down its stipulations to all subgrantees, including those that never received any U.S. government funds. Shortly after the Trump administration reinstated the GGR, the Global Health Justice and Governance Program at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, where I work as a senior program officer, received funding from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation and the David and Lucille Packard Foundation to document the policy's impact in Kenya, Madagascar, and Nepal. Those of us at the Global Health Justice and Governance Program felt a responsibility as a Global North institution, not only to acknowledge the immense risk that our foreign policy in the U.S. poses to aid-dependent nations in the Global South, but also to take an active role in disrupting geographies of power by prioritizing the leadership of partners in affected countries as we collectively studied the policy's impacts and also disseminated the findings for use in local as well as in U.S. advocacy. We worked in this project with the African Population Health Research Center in Kenya, the National Institute for Public Health and Community Health in Madagascar, and the Center for Research on the Environment, Health, and Population Activities in Nepal. We also collaborated with service delivery and advocacy organizations like IPAS and Planned Parenthood Global in the design and dissemination of this research. To facilitate global results sharing as part of this dissemination process, the Global Health Justice and Governance Program collaborated with the SRHM Journal to produce a special issue entitled Exporting Harm, Impact of the Expanded Global Gag Rule on Sexual and Reproductive Health and Rights. The special issue includes research findings from Kenya, Madagascar, and Nepal, as well as a collection of commentaries authored by global and in-country experts. Those commentaries further contextualize the research findings by describing the policy's effects on countries' health systems, the humanitarian sector, legal systems, and advocacy efforts. Today, I'll dig into the special issue further in conversation with authors of three of the research and commentary articles included: Patty Schuster, Anand Tamang, and Evelyn Opondo. So Patty, to start with, I'm going to just introduce you briefly for our audience. Patty Schuster is the Beck Chair in Law at Temple Law School and a fellow with the Center for Public Health Law Research. Prior to joining Temple, Patty spent 15 years at the global health organization, IPAS. With two of her former colleagues at IPAS, Patty co-authored a commentary in the SRHM special issue entitled Relics of Imperialism, U.S. Foreign Policy on Abortion in the COVID Era. Patty, to start off, I have a pretty broad question, but wondered if you could give us a brief summary of your take on the last 35 years since the GGR was first introduced. And specifically, I wonder if you could tell us about the global trends in abortion law and policy during that time.
Thanks, Emily. And I'm really happy to be here. I do want to go even further back beyond the global gag rule and mention the Helms Amendment as well, which is another restriction on abortion funding, which has been in place since 1973. Since the Helms Amendment and the GGR were enacted in the 70s and 80s, abortion laws have changed significantly. At that time, in the 1970s and 80s, abortion laws were still very restrictive for people living in countries that receive U.S. foreign assistance. In many cases, these were colonial-era abortion laws, which reflected the outdated laws of colonizing countries, even as governments in Europe and North America liberalized their own abortion laws. But this changed over the past 35, 40 years. We've seen huge shifts in the legal environment for abortion at both the global and the national level toward less restrictive abortion laws. If we go back just to the 1994 International Conference on Population and Development, since 1994, 50 countries around the world have liberalized their abortion laws. Many of these reforms took place in countries that receive U.S. health assistance and therefore were affected by the global gag rule as well as the Helms Amendment. These changes have happened through legislative efforts or courts declaring restrictive abortion laws incompatible with constitutional rights, including Mexico just a few months ago. At the global level, treaty monitoring bodies, that is, human rights authorities charged with overseeing UN human rights treaties, these and other human rights experts have recognized links between access to legal abortion and human rights, including the right to privacy, non-discrimination, the right to life and health. And human rights experts have pointed to the need to reform restrictive laws to comply with human rights. I'll mention, too, that the way abortion takes place is also changing. Everywhere, people are increasingly ending pregnancies through self-managed abortion, taking pills to end pregnancies without clinical supervision, and sometimes bypassing the regulatory environment completely. So we're living in a different time when it comes to not only abortion law and policy, but also practice since the global gag rule.
So then if we zoom back over to the global gag rule for a moment, it sounds like what you're saying is that the Trump administration's twice expanded policy really goes against the grain of this global progress on abortion law policy and, as you mentioned, accessibility.
Very much so. Advocates and governments around the world have reformed abortion laws really despite the global gag rule. And while we know the effect of the expanded global gag rule during the Trump presidency was significant, we can't lose sight of the aggregate impact of U.S. foreign policy on abortion over decades. The global gag rule is not a light switch. When the policy is rescinded, it takes time for grantees to receive information about the end of the global gag rule. And after that, it takes time for organizations to plan, fund, and implement abortion work. NGO staff who have been involved in USAID-funded work over several years are well aware that the global gag rule may return and know it may not be strategic to resume work on abortion. So we really see a large-scale chilling effect over decades.
And earlier you referenced the Helms Amendment, which you described, and if anyone is unfamiliar, it sounds quite similar to the GGR, but the Helms Amendment prohibits U.S. foreign assistance from paying for abortions. Together, the Helms Amendment and the GGR represent a U.S. foreign policy position that really excludes abortion outright. What does this position mean for the rest of the world, given the role of the U.S.? And also, what does this mean for the progress that you described earlier?
Look, the U.S. government is the largest bilateral funder of reproductive health across the globe. We are influential. And U.S. lawmakers are unusual in this country in the amount of time and attention they pay to restricting abortion. Just to give an example of state legislatures in the U.S. have enacted hundreds of different types of abortion restrictions over the past decade. So the U.S. alone restricts abortion through foreign policy. The 1973 Helms Amendment, as you said, Emily, basically says U.S. foreign assistance cannot be used for abortion. In contrast, just to make this clear, the global gag rule dictates what organizations do with their private funding and is on and off, depending on who is in the White House, while the Helms Amendment has stayed in force since 1973, prohibiting abortion in U.S.-funded projects. I'll mention, too, its domestic corollary, the 1976 Hyde Amendment, which bans abortion coverage for Americans who get their health care through federal programs. U.S. foreign policy isolates abortion from other reproductive health services, basically banishing people who work on abortion from U.S. projects. All U.S.-funded reproductive health initiatives, from clinics, training, publications, conferences, they all exclude abortion from efforts around reproductive health care. We have documentation of instances where USAID staff has told grantees they cannot present data on abortion incidents, and where USAID has cautioned grantees about even attending presentations on abortion. Abortion is left out of U.S.-funded training. One USAID-funded trainer relayed to me when I was working for IPAS that staff of the USAID cooperating agency had told her not to even answer trainees' questions on abortion. It's as though U.S. government has created these imagined environments where everyone pretends that no one ever needs an abortion and that abortion doesn't happen. And consider again that this is all taking place in environments where national governments are moving ahead to improve access to abortion. I think the larger effects of U.S. foreign policy on abortion are unknown, undocumented. For example, what is the effect of abortion stigma when grantees are told abortion is not a type of legitimate health care, that you're not to speak of it? And what is the effect of this particular source of stigma on national level policymaking on abortion?
And where or how do you believe that unmeasured impact has played out?
The U.S. government has deemed abortion a forbidden topic globally. Given the U.S. influence, the impact has been far-reaching in ways that are measurable, but to measure them would require time, resources, and in the involvement of skilled researchers. For example, we can certainly trace U.S. influence to UNFPA's reluctance to work on abortion and the peculiar treatment of abortion in the 1994 ICPD Program of Action. I wonder what would change if abortion was integrated into U.S.-funded reproductive health initiatives and policy, positions, diplomacy. What has been the impact of the omission of abortion? It would be a very worthwhile project to measure the broader effects of U.S. abortion policy in international development and then identify steps to correct it.
Thank you for sharing a wonderful research idea, Patty. I would love to work on that as well. And Moving forward and zooming back out now from the GGR, what can the world expect from the US? How are things shifting in a post-Trump presidency and even beyond that?
As many of us are well aware, when this podcast airs, the US Supreme Court will have heard arguments to consider the Mississippi pre-viability abortion ban, which is a direct challenge to Roe v. Wade. Americans are at risk of losing our own right to abortion. We're dealing with a conservative court that has agreed to consider whether to uphold Roe v. Wade and the right to abortion under the U.S. Constitution. In the not-so-distant future, state governments in the U.S. may be able to ban abortion should the Supreme Court further shrink or overrule abortion rights under Roe v. Wade. And this could influence the actions of governments in other countries. Despite our domestic policy environment, we still can point to progress in the U.S. Members of Congress are paying new attention to the way abortion law and policy has disparate effects on different groups of people. We know that people who are advantaged everywhere are able to safely end their pregnancy, while funding restrictions like the Hyde and Helms Amendment reinforce discrimination. We can see progress in the fact that the U.S. Congress is considering bills to end both the Hyde and Helms Amendment, as well as a global gag rule. The Abortion is Healthcare Everywhere Act, which repeals the Helms Amendment, has 170 co-sponsors in the House of Representatives. This is something that I would not have believed is possible just a few years ago. We must also keep in mind that the effect of abortion law and policy is more complex due to the growing use of self-managed abortion. Abortion outside former healthcare settings can be safe. This was most recently found in an IBIS safe study to reinforce what a growing body of evidence around the safety of self-managed abortion. So when abortion is moved out of the formal healthcare setting, the effect of abortion law and policy may be muted or at least different. And this includes the impact of the global gag rule. So we'll see a changing relationship between abortion policy and health in the context of self-managed abortion, but another important area for inquiry.
Thank you so much, Patty, for helping us to better understand and also situate the GGR before we dig into more conversation about national level effects with our other speakers. Our next speaker, Anand Tamang, is the founding director of CREPA, a research organization based in Kathmandu, Nepal, that collaborated with the Global Health, Justice, and Governance Program to study the impacts of the GGR. Anand, before we get into the findings, I wonder if you could say just a bit more about the Nepal study for our listeners.
Thank you, Emily. In the study, we have used qualitative study design that examined the impact of the policy at different levels of the health system. Altogether, 205 interviews were conducted with the government, NGO, and facility-based staff. It was a mix of NGOs. Some certified the GGR and some did not. Some were prime grantees and some were sub-grantees. We interviewed participants from NGO and private health facilities, many of whom were affiliated with two foreign NGOs that did not certify the GGR and had to end a large US-funded family planning project because of that.
Now, turning to some impacts, what would you say were some of the key impacts or most surprising to you, perhaps, of this Trump GGR in Nepal?
Compliant NGOs who had applied for the abortion funding were asked to choose between the U.S. fund and the abortion fund. NGOs who were recipients of the U.S. funds were under constant scrutiny. They were restricted to attend abortion-related meetings or workshops and even express their views on abortion matters. Likewise, non-certifying NGOs attending a public sector meetings were censored from speaking on abortion-related matters there if the meetings were USAID funded. So this impact results from the chilling effect that the policy has, namely over-restricting activities and speech out of the fear of being penalized by the US government. The policy does not actually bar people from attending meetings or participating in discussion about abortion.
I too found the chilling effect and the data around the chilling effect, particularly in Nepal, to be quite striking. It was quite a palpable feeling and clearly affected organizations, health services, and trainings, for example, as you mentioned, in ways that one might not expect. So thank you for bringing that up today. We also had some impacts at the facility level, and I wonder if you could share some of those with us as well.
Yes. Early closure of the large USG-funded final planning project, which is called SIPO2, affecting two leading national NGOs. It led to the closing of their community clinics, staff layoffs, and diminished capacity of the public sector providers, especially on long-acting contraceptives such as the implant and IUCD, because the NGOs had to stop training public sector providers. The affected NGOs also experienced a decline in abortion client flow since the policy strictly forbade compliant NGOs working with the female beneficiaries such as sex workers, HIV clients, and bisexual women from referring these women desirous to terminate an unwanted pregnancy to a safe abortion clinic of these non-compliant NGOs. One national NGO implementing the SIPO2 project, which was USAID funded, was not allowed to utilize this project's underutilized clinic staff at a time when its regular SRS programs in the clinic experience overcrowding with the clients.
So just as you described with the chilling effects, the implementation of the policy and non-compliance of two major NGOs in Nepal really affected the makeup of the health system, again, trainings, but also the services that clients were allowed to seek, and especially given the country's work to improve contraceptive method mix and choice for people seeking contraceptives, this work was really halted by the GGR. And it's worth noting that the family planning work, not just the SIPO2 project, but decades of family planning projects in Nepal that have really tried to improve that method mix, provide more trainings in the public sector, have been long supported by the US government. So the GGR really counters the government's own investments in Nepal and other countries as well. And I think we'll hear more about that in the rest of our conversation today. Anand, the GGR was rescinded by President Biden in January of 2021. And you and I are collaborating again on some research to understand how that change is felt on the ground in Nepal. Can you share any preliminary findings from that research?
Yes, the study is on progress, but some of the preliminary findings are, earlier this year, around March, April, compliant NGOs were told about the resentment of the GGR by their primes. However, no detailed information regarding the implication of the resentment on their work on SRH has been shared to them thus far. The policy change has opened up partnership opportunities for many of the local NGOs and even applied for USAID-funded programs in the country. We found some USG-funded sub-recipients that work with female beneficiaries are happy with the policy change as they feel that they can formally refer women, that is their clients, who need an abortion to a safe abortion clinic.
So it's looking like there are some positive changes, but the communication and guidance from USAID and from prime NGOs is not clear enough to assure formerly compliant subrecipients in many cases that they can stop implementing the policy. So what lingering or long-term effects of the GGR remain today in Nepal?
NGOs who are solely dependent upon the US government funds, they desire to remain clean and faithful and do not wish to antagonize their primes and donors. These NGOs are also aware of the policy that gets re-enacted and rescinded with the every change in the US president at the White House. Hence, they feel safe not to indulge in any abortion-related matters, which in other words is a case of self-censorship, which can linger for a longer time in Nepal. And another long-term effect of the GGR in Nepal is the widening of funding gaps, basically reduction in the number of donor-funded projects that do not require GGR compliance, which affect SRS, including safe abortion services in Nepal, which is a need of the day.
Thank you, Anand, for giving us such a great summary of these research impacts. And for anyone looking to learn more about this research, you can find the research article included in the SRHM special issue on the GGR, as well as the research articles from Kenya and from Madagascar. I'm excited to speak next with Evelyn Opondo, Senior Regional Director for Africa at the Center for Reproductive Rights. Evelyn authored a commentary in the SRHM special issue on the GGR entitled Perspectives of an SRHR Advocate on the Impact of the Global Gag Rule in Kenya. Evelyn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Emily.
In your commentary, you situate the GGR within a hostile anti-SRHR climate in Kenya. And of the three countries included in the research that the Global Health, Justice, and Governance Program was involved in, Kenya really stood apart for the size and influence of this anti-choice movement, which you describe as emboldened by the global gag rule. To start off, could you give us a sense of what this opposition looks like? Who are the key players and what are their strategies?
The SRHR opposition players that we are seeing in Kenya and across Africa are, one, religious groups. We are seeing this in the form of evangelicals who mostly have their roots in the US. We are also seeing the Catholic Church that has remained really strong against sexual reproductive health rights over a period of time. And secondly, we are also seeing religious affiliated professional associations. For example, we are seeing the Catholic Doctors Association and we are seeing Kenya Christian Lawyers Association. And then we are also seeing civil society organizations, and some of them are indeed global organizations with their roots, for example, in the US or in Spain that we have seen. And then you have also asked about the strategies that they have employed. They have used a number of strategies, and one of them is legal strategies. In Kenya, for example, they have instituted litigation where they are seeking to introduce extraneous clinical regulations for abortion providers. They are also seeking recognition of fetal rights. These are tactics that they have employed in the US and in other regions. And they are using them in Kenya with support from other anti-SRHR groups in those countries. We are also seeing the harassment that they are visiting on healthcare providers, particularly abortion providers. They're using threats and criminal prosecutions against providers. And this has created a chilling effect to the extent that we are now seeing providers in certain instances unwilling to provide abortion services, even where those services are legal within the law. The opposition groups are also using coordinated miscommunication and disinformation on SRHR. For example, they have targeted not only abortion, but they are also targeting in vitro fertilization. They are also targeting comprehensive sexuality education, amongst others, and using this to harass not only SRHR advocates, but also providers and champions of SRHR.
So then, what are some of the outcomes of these varied tactics that you've seen employed in Kenya?
The outcomes of their tactics are diverse. We are seeing continuous stigmatization and harassment of abortion champions For example, they are profiling and stigmatizing members of parliament who have stood in support of bills on SRHR. They have also intimidated government officials, including in the Ministry of Health. The Ministry of Health is in charge of developing policies and implementing policies, not only on abortion, but broadly on health. The opposition groups have intimidated progressive officials within the Ministry of Health in Kenya to the extent that the Ministry of Health is unwilling and is shying away from supporting, defending, or implementing its own progressive policies. We have also seen these groups have targeted individuals that they see as champions of abortion and threatened their life. In some instances, they have succeeded in banning abortion services. For example, a few years ago, they instituted a complaint against Maristops Kenya, and the complaint ended up in Maristops Kenya services being banned, including post-abortion care that they were providing. And even though we have challenged this in court, the chilling effect remains. And so we have to continuously push back on their strategies in order for us to even realize the constitutional promise on abortion.
Wow, thank you, Evelyn, for shining a light on this very complex and troubling context. And this is all even before we consider the added effects that the GGR and other foreign assistance policies have. You wrote in your commentary that the Kenyan Ministry of Health was playing in tune with USAID in downplaying and sometimes disavowing its own policy decisions related to SRHR, as you said. How did the GGR then embolden this opposition in Kenya?
The GGR has emboldened the opposition in Kenya. Remember, during this time, they had this huge political support from a powerful country such as the US. And so with that in mind, the GGR hindered access to services and information. The impact of this rule has been devastating and has impacted operations of many healthcare provider organizations. For example, the Family Health Options Kenya reported a reduction of about 60% of its funding, which had resulted in halting some of its services. And the GGR did not only affect abortion services, it also affected services around HIV, services around access to contraceptives, because these are the same organizations, these are the same providers that were providing these services. And so when you take away the funding from this organization, it affects them across the board. Another impact of the GGR was that for us as abortion advocates and SRHR organizations, we were excluded from so many key meetings and partnerships, especially by organizations who had signed onto the GGR. This strained the ability for coalition building around issues, which is really critical for progressive change around SRHR broadly. And then thirdly, the GGR resulted in significant increase of resources to opposition groups, which was bolstered by strong political support from powerful nations such as the US. And this was coupled by intimidation to countries such as my own country, Kenya, was intimidated by the US through its GGR to the extent that it did not matter that the Kenyan constitution provides for abortion under certain circumstances. The US, through its policy, did not recognize this, and therefore putting our government in a situation where the government was unwilling to implement or defend its own constitution.
In such a daunting context, how are SRHR advocates and activists in Kenya responding to the GGR and other anti-SRHR tactics? Are there any bright spots for us to look towards?
Yes. As advocates, we are continuously pushing for the implementation of progressive laws and policies And where we have regressive laws and policies, and sometimes even practices, we are challenging those and insisting on revising them. We are also putting in place efforts to support abortion providers and to cushion them against the harassment that they are seeing from opposition groups, but also from police and from the government in certain instances. We have also put in place communication strategies that allows us to communicate to the general public, to the providers, and to policymakers what it is that the law provides, but also let the public know what is provided within the law and the services they can access and where they can access those services. And finally, we are also collaborating with women's rights organizations, health organizations, and broad human rights movement so that we are speaking together as a united voice against opposition on SRHR.
Thank you, Evelyn. I'm really struck by how unique some of the GGR's impacts are in Kenya and Nepal, and at the same time, how similar others are across countries and over time, as indicated through our conversation with Patty earlier. So for those who are listening and would like to access the research articles and commentaries authored by our speakers, you can visit the SRHM special issue website, and there you'll find additional articles and commentaries that dig into impacts in other countries, as well as commentaries that reflect how the GGR affects other systems, not only health systems and advocacy, civil society, but also humanitarian sector and legal systems in the US, globally, and in some select countries as well. So please take a look at that. Thank you so much to Patty, Evelyn, and Anand for this really rich discussion today.
Thank you to Emily Mestralis, Patty Schuster, Anand Tamang, and Evelyn Apondo for this insightful conversation. To read the special issue on the Global Gag Rule, visit srhm.org. All articles are available online and free of charge. Follow SRHM Journal on social media or sign up for our newsletter to receive notifications for new research. Thank you for supporting the SRHM podcast, which is produced by the SRHM staff. The music was composed by Thibert Christian and Salomon Bouton.